Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Freeform, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law School professor, and author most recently of They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, and Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, just about any podcast site you can find. A quick plug for participation. Here's six organizations that you can stay in touch with if you want to be an active participant in our democracy. Indivisible.us.org.com. Indivisible, about 5,000 chapters locally, and they'll send you a list of five things you might do every week. MoveOn.org, MoveOn, one word, .org. A longtime digital activist organization, now very much coordinating with the grassroots. That's on a national level. On a California level, Courage Campaign, one word, .org, digital, aligned with grassroots. Fivecalls.org, that's the number five and the word calls. Fivecalls.org tells you timely and relevant calls you might make about legislation or issues that are up at the moment. Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com tells you when your representatives are going to be visiting home and when you can go meet them in person. And finally, since climate change is such a crucial issue, 350, the number 350.org, probably the biggest global advocacy organization on climate change. Now to today's guest. Lawrence Lessig opens the preface to his newest book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy, with a short list of some of the most critical problems America is not solving: climate change, healthcare, infrastructure, hopelessness. I found myself nodding as I read. Then he makes clear that this cannot be blamed on Donald Trump. Lessig writes, quote, "The crisis in America is not its president. Its president is the consequence of a crisis much more fundamental. We tell ourselves that these more fundamental problems must wait. Yet that is precisely the thinking that got us here. The system that has failed America will not change unless we challenge and make it change." I know he's right. I've been making the point for years that whatever your issue is campaign finance. After the 2004 election, I pushed a restored democracy trifecta: media reform, campaign finance reform, and election reform. In the 15 years since, the media has morphed into something more dangerous, relying more and more on technologies that manipulate our neural response system in ways we could hardly have imagined back then. But can we find the will and the ability to take on the other two, campaign finance and elections? Or is it too late? Have we degraded the quality of our shared understanding so that we now lack the fabric necessary to deliver the reforms we desperately need? Lessig calls for urgency, but he is willing to make the case that it's not too late. And he aims his book and his work on the ground with Equal Citizens to be realistic. He believes, quote, "The core problem with our democracy today is that it is essentially unrepresentative. We should secure, finally, a representative democracy. We've never had it. So let's just try it for once. Let's see what happens with 10 years of a truly representative democracy. Let's see if things get better." By the way, Lessig believes that we the people are also to blame. We're increasingly uninformed about the issues, and incessant political polling reflects and normalizes our ignorance, feeding it back into the system as representative of our will. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. He serves on the advisory boards of Creative Commons, of which he's a co-founder, and the Sunlight Foundation. He's been named one of Scientific America's top 50 visionaries, and his books include The Future of Ideas, Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy, Republic Lost, Versions 1 and 2, and his latest, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Lessig also hosts the weekly podcast, Another Way, and you can learn more at Lessig, L-E-S-S-I-G.org, and at EqualCitizens.us. Welcome again, Lawrence Lessig, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and let me tell people that we're recording this conversation Monday, November 18th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people, not just the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you talk briefly about your path to the work you do today? Feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision. And I followed you first, an activist on internet issues and Creative Commons, then money in politics, and now this broader approach to representation. How do you see your evolution?
Well, you know, I have forever had this anxiety about the failure of our democracy, which I think is a failure that has grown substantially in the last decade. But the reality is that I was turned to take up this project by a dear friend who we lost to suicide, a boy named Aaron Swartz, who in 2007, he visited me when I was in Berlin, actually just at the end of 2006. And I was proudly telling him about the new book I was about to publish, which was called Remix, and I was going to have my first TED talk about copyright and the fight for creativity. And he was strangely unexcited, given that these were the projects that we had worked on together. And at a certain point, he said, "So why do you think you're ever going to succeed on these questions of internet policy or copyright, so long as we have such a deeply corrupted government?" And, you know, I was a little bit miffed that he was not excited about, you know, what I was talking about because we had worked on this for so long. And I said, "You know, Aaron, it's just not my field." And he said, "You mean your field is an academic?" And I said, "Yes, an academic. I work on copyright issues, the internet, and I don't work on government corruption." And he said, "Okay, but what about as a citizen? Is it your field as a citizen?"
Mm.
And you know, he had me there because, you know, the reality is I had tenure. I had, you know, spent a long time working on the copyright internet stuff. I could, you know, easily imagine spending the rest of my life, like, tweaking the argument and continuing to make the case. And I felt like I was, you know, kind of at the prime of my career on that. But I didn't really have a good reason to resist what he was trying to get me to do because he was right, and I knew he was right. And so literally that night, I committed to him that I was going to give up the work on copyright and the internet and take up this work on corruption, or institutional corruption, as I thought about it back then. And that summer I announced it, and that fall he and I started the first organization that I was that I built to try to build a movement around this, and that was called Change Congress in 2007.
Okay, could you briefly, I want to ask about a couple of your experiences along the way. One is you clerked under Antonin Scalia as a young law school grad, right? And people might find that surprising. Any reflections on that time and what you sort of gathered from that?
Well, you know, I clerked as Scalia's token liberal clerk at the stage of his career where he still had token liberal clerks in his chambers. It was my job to, you know, to cause trouble and to press him on the sort of questions or issues that the other conservative clerks would not. Later in his career, he seemed to have given up the practice of hiring liberal clerks, and I asked him once why, and he said, "Well, you know, I figured everything out. I don't really need anybody to question me anymore." But, you know, at that stage of his career, he really was, I think, still genuinely trying to work it out. And, you know, he had a very committed theory of constitutional interpretation called originalism. And there are many times when originalism conflicted with conservative principles, or, you know, not the sort of thing that a conservative would instinctively want to do. And the most important areas where that happened was in the questions of criminal rights, or the rights, civil rights as they related to criminal practice. And there are any number of times during the course of that year when, you know, there would be a conflict between his views as a conservative and his views as an originalist, and every one of those times he would eventually kind of come around to the views as an originalist. So it was, you know, in some sense, for me, kind of surprising and inspirational to see that, you know, the political desires of this justice could be bent to what he stated was his philosophy, his judicial philosophy. But my job was in that sense to press him and to test him, and sometimes, you know, I think that he came around to judgments that in the long term seemed to be much better than they would have been.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, a few years later, he thought he'd learned it all, so some of it he picked up from you.
I won't claim that.
Thank you. And by the way, I did, when you were telling that initial story about Aaron Swartz, I did want to say that that's quite a powerful, you know, I ask this question about turning points and moments of decision. And that's quite a powerful one. Of course, when he challenges you and you pick up the challenge, you don't know that his days are numbered at that point.
Yeah.
But
I kind of expected he would be with me on the fight. Very quickly after I took it up, he became obsessed with the hopefulness of the Obama administration. And he then went off and started taking up a very strong progressive cause. He started this group called Bold Progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And I would chastise him because, you know, I would say to him, why does he ever think he's going to get any of these progressive ideas enacted given the corrupt Congress that we have? I think early in the Obama administration, he really kind of thought that Obama was going to either fix it or be able to rise above it. And of course, I was committed to the view that was not going to happen until we did what Obama told us we had to do in 2008, when he would give speeches and he would say all the time, if we don't take up the fight to change the way Washington works, then real change that would make a lasting difference in the lives of ordinary Americans, will keep getting blocked by the defenders of the status quo. And that was right then, and it's still right today. And that was the fight, I think, that he tried to get me to take up, even though he abandoned it for
mm-hmm.
a while.
Mm-hmm. Larry, when it fits, I use a format I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It, which consists of three big questions. So here the issue is representative democracy in the U.S. And the three questions, and it really seems that they're pretty much what shapes your book, is it broken? What's the evidence? And then how did it get broken? What's the history? How did we get here? And then finally, how do we fix it? So we're going to roam around point by point and so on, but essentially we're going to seek to answer those three questions in the time we have left. So that first one, what is the evidence? And I'll just let you, you know, do a small litany because the evidence is pretty damning, that representative democracy in the U.S. is broken.
Well, it's first really important to be clear about how it's broken. There are many people who think it's broken because it's a system that just bends to the interests of the rich or to the plutocracy. And of course, it does do that in a certain class of cases, especially around taxes. And it does do that to the extent that it does it because of the way we fund our campaigns. But part of the argument of the book is that, you know, we have so many inequalities built into our democracy. Funding of campaigns is one, gerrymandering is another, the suppression of votes is another, the Electoral College is another, the Senate is another. And not all of those inequalities actually are directly beneficial of the rich. So the problem that we've evolved is not just that to the extent the government acts, it acts to benefit the rich. It's also that in the main, the government just can't act. It just doesn't have the capacity to act. And this is a dynamic which Francis Fukuyama has referred to as a vitocracy, meaning a system where any small number of people can block the ability of the entity to act. Our Constitution has always been vulnerable to that charge. It's always been a very delicate structure because of checks and balances. But because of these inequalities that we've allowed to evolve, it is now an extremely delicate system of government. It's almost impossible to get anything serious through this government because there's so many places or opportunities for powerful entities to block it. So I think the first thing to do is recognize what is the problem. One of the biggest problems is the inability of our government to govern. And then the second dimension of this problem is, to the extent that it does govern, it's not governing in a way that actually reflects what the people would want. And the best evidence of this is this extraordinary study by Martin Gillens and Ben Page, which was the largest empirical study of the actual decisions of our government, maybe in the history of political science, relating those decisions to the economic elite, typically, you know, the kind of class that's funding campaigns, and then organized interest groups, and then the average voter. And what they found is there's a very strong correlation between the attitudes of the economic elite and what our government does, meaning as the percentage of the economic elite who support something goes from 0 to 100%, the probability of that thing having been enacted goes up to about a maximum, I believe that number is something like 34% or 36%. The same thing with organized interest groups. The more that's supported, the more likely it is that it gets enacted. But when you look at the graph for the average voter, this has been, Vox called this the most terrifying graph in American politics, the average voter graph, the line is a flat line. And what the flat line means is it doesn't matter the percentage of average voters who support something. It doesn't change the probability that that thing would have been enacted. So 0% of the average voters support something and 100% of the average voters support something. The chances of that thing being enacted were the same. And what that means is the system is not responding to the wishes of the average voter. What the system is responding to is to the wishes of the elites or these organized interest groups. And to the extent that's true, then what we have what they've demonstrated is this representative democracy is just simply no longer, or if it ever was, it certainly now is not representative.
Right, not representative of we the people. Now, a point you made in there is that they had to study what actually happened, and then they had to study what the people claimed they wanted to have happen. And so that gets us to polling. And you have said, I'm going to read a quote here, we have evolved a democracy that takes seriously the views of the people as expressed in polling just at the moment when the people have become so fragmented and polarized and misinformed as to be embarrassing. So I'm shifting a little bit. I mean, I think that that study, I've quoted it many times in the show, that study is the sort of the reality check on anybody who thinks things aren't as bad as we may say they are. But what about this question of becoming more, if not necessarily reliant on polling, but pointing to this is the people's opinion as if that poll really registers that?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that I think we need to be skeptical of attitudes Americans express through polls more today than in the past, but certainly today. And I'm happy to, you know, and of course the Martin, the Gillens and Page piece is not based on a single poll. It's based on
right.
incredible aggregation of as many of these polls across a very long period of time. So to the extent that the problem I'm describing is a post-broadcast democracy problem, at least half of what they're talking about comes from the broadcast democracy period.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm happy to say let's be skeptical of polls. But then I want to say, what? At least let the polls shift the burden.
Right.
You know,
what else?
What else do we look at? So the polls show, relating to what the government did, the government doesn't respond to what the people want. So what do we have that shows that the government's responding to what the people want? And of course, there's not only not any good evidence that their government's responding, in my view, it's also pretty clear there's no reason for them to be, right? Because to the extent they are obsessively focused on the things that they need day-to-day to survive, the things they need day-to-day to survive, the discipline that we've built into their life is a focus, an obsessive focus, either to the extremes of their party, that's the consequence of gerrymandering, or to the needs of the funders of their campaigns, which they spend 30 to 70% of their time sucking up to the funders of their campaigns. So these two realities of the day-to-day dynamic of the incentives of being a representative in the United States Congress, I think make completely plausible the conclusion that in the end, when you look at what they've done or what they do, they don't seem to be caring much about what ordinary people would want.
Right. And another piece of that question I raised was just this question of if you are going to say a representative democracy and you're going to say representing the people's will, are the people informed enough to have an informed will? Is there even the possibility of an informed citizenry these days? And you make, I'm gonna quote you again, both the media and the politicians have a deep interest in rendering us a bunch of crazies. They want to keep us passionate in our radical little corners because it pays them so well. Speak to that a bit.
Yeah, I think that what has happened is that the business model of fragmented politics, like the business model of fragmented media, is actually perverse to the ideals of democracy. Like, the return, the reward in both media and politics comes from rendering us as crazy and as extreme as we can be. That's what returns to the advertisers, and that's also what returns people's passion to get engaged and come out and vote and to give money in the context of political campaigns. So that's the reality of fragmented politics and fragmented media, and I think that's something to lament. But I actually think that, you know, part of the objective of the book is to say, look, there's a conception of how we could be selecting representatives and how we should think about representatives that wouldn't require that each of us be kind of geeky experts on every single public policy issue that there is, but instead would trade on the sort of thing that we as ordinary humans are pretty good at, which is trying to identify people that we trust and seem to embrace values that we know that we share. So, you know, if you, I'm a progressive in Massachusetts, where it seems everybody is, but, you know, at least 1 million people voted for Trump. So most of us, didn't. It's not hard for me to look at a potential candidate running for United States Senate, like, you know, Joe Kennedy, and look at what he's done and look at the kind of person he is and look at the way that he talks and feel like I know enough, even if I'm not a geek on every one of the issues that he might be caring about, to have a reason to support him. And that's the kind of connection that we as voters need to have with these representatives. And I think that the trouble that we have for representative democracy is when we try to go 10 steps beyond that and start imagining a constant and perpetual monitoring by we the people of what the representatives are doing, as if we are really capable, not intellectually capable, but just practically capable of understanding the trade-offs and the issues enough to be able to exercise any useful judgment in that context.
So you've focused on the problem as that our system has become unrepresentative, and then you say that there is a perennial dynamic of populism, that when hope fades, anger flourishes, and so that, I believe, and I think this is an agreement with you, is a response to the unrepresentative nature. And then you say, and I'm setting up the urgency of your book and the urgency of this conversation, is that if we had 20 years to solve these problems, we'd do a concerted check everything out, try everything for 20 years. But when we're talking about climate change, when we're talking about healthcare, when we're talking about infrastructure, we do not have 20 years. And I think it's those two things, right? The populist angry reaction to what's happening and the urgency of change that leads to the moment that you sat down and said, this is the book that's got to come out and this is the work I've got to do.
Exactly right. And, you know, it's kind of, this is what just old people say, but, you know, it's astonishing for me to look back and to think it's been 12 years that I've been in this fight. And I remember right at the beginning of this fight, having arguments with climate activists, for example, and saying, look, you know, I'm with you. I completely agree. Climate change is the issue. If we don't find a way to fix this, we're toast. This is terrible. Let's find a way to fix this. But when I would say the way to fix this is to get us a government that could actually represent us, because you're never going to get climate change passed in a world where coal companies and oil companies or the carbon monopolies fund campaigns. It's not possible. So rather than doing the impossible, why not let's figure out how to make it so that what you're arguing for would be possible? And I remember viscerally these people lecturing me about how we don't have time to fix the democracy. What we have to do is to fix the climate. And there was a sense of, I just, this is so sad, because, you know, I was hoping that they were right. I was hoping I'd be proven wrong. But then watching, even as the Obama administration, with a supermajority in the Senate and in the House, refused to take up the climate change bill and to get it passed, because they knew the consequence of that would be an extraordinary flood of money that would come in from the oil companies and the coal companies to defeat Democrats. When that was so obvious, it just seemed to me that that we had to find a way to get people to recognize the urgency of this. And still, that was, you know, 8 years ago, which is, again, incredibly depressing.
Right. What you just said reminded me, their fear of the money that would flood the midterms was that the Clinton administration came in, also had House and Senate, and needed to pass raise taxes because of the deficits that had been built up prior to them. And 43 Democratic congressmen who had voted for that tax increase were defeated. And that ended up leading to the impeachment and the basically wasted second term of Bill Clinton. So the fear was real. You make a key point that separates you, let's say, from a lot of people, maybe the diagnosis of Bernie Sanders, of Elizabeth Warren, to some extent, in which you say that our actual system, though Citizens United and super PACs and that number that legislators spend 30-70% of their time dialing for dollars, but you say our actual system doesn't benefit the elite on balance. It benefits no one.
Yeah. Because, and it's hard to know how you reckon this. Like, what is the net benefit to each of the particular groups that you can look at? But again, what I think is when you look at the different ways in which the inequalities in our system matter, they clearly matter to benefit the rich when you think about the way we fund campaigns. That's easy. When you think about the things Donald Trump has been able to do, he's been able to do things that benefit the rich. So a $1.6 trillion tax cut, which benefits corporations and the super rich, is possible because this dynamic is so pervasive across the political parties. Indeed, there was a New York congressman who stood on the floor of Congress before that was passed and said, my donors have told me that if I don't get this passed, I should never call them again. So there was the plainest example of money driving the result. But when you think about gerrymandering, as I describe it in the book, the core concern that many politicians have about gerrymandering is that we gerrymander districts to produce as many safe seats as we can. So maybe 85% of the seats in the House are safe seats, meaning we know the party that's going to win. But when you know the party that's going to win, you don't know who in the party is going to win, meaning that the incumbent is constantly anxious that he or she's going to be challenged, and when challenged, possibly defeated. Now, the most likely challenger who can defeat a member who's sitting in Congress is a challenger from the more extreme end of that party, because we know that primaries, which is where that challenge happens, are dominated by the extremists in both parties because they are the most politically active. They're the people who show up. So if you're a right-wing Republican, you're not afraid of a Democrat beating you. You're not afraid of a moderate Republican beating you. What you're afraid of is an even more right-wing Republican beating you. And if you're a left-wing Democrat, you're not worried about a Republican beating you or a moderate Democrat beating you. What you're worried about is an even more progressive Democrat. So that means that these members are constantly looking to their flanks. They're constantly focused on how do I make sure that I don't get outflanked by the left or by the right, depending on who they are. Well, that's not necessarily the rich. I wouldn't say that the Democratic Socialists in the Democratic Party are rich. I mean, some of them are, but that's not the movement. And so the point is that dynamic is not a dynamic necessarily benefiting the rich. Or the suppression of the vote. Many people see this, and I'm sure a huge chunk of it is motivated by race, no doubt. Like in Georgia, you look at the suppression of vote, and it's hard not to see that as motivated by race. But the more general dynamic there is political. It's the party in power using their power to screw the party that's trying to take them out by a party that's trying to beat them, by making it harder for members of that party to vote. Now, mostly that reads in racial terms when you've got Southern white Republicans who are using their power to suppress Democrats who are largely African Americans, or at least that's the easiest group of Democrats to disempower. But again, that dynamic doesn't necessarily skew towards money. It's skewing towards politics. And finally, the Electoral College is, a really dramatic example of this. The Electoral College is this incredible distortion in itself, but it's an even greater distortion because of the way states allocate their electors. All but two states allocate their electors on a winner-take-all formula, meaning if you win even one more vote than the second highest vote getter in the state, you get all of the Electoral College votes from that state. And what that means is the only states that matter to presidential candidates are states that are so-called swing states, states that could go one way or the other. In 2016, 95% of candidate appearances were in 14 states. 99% of campaign spending was in 14 states. And that's because those were the swing states, and it would be idiotic to waste your time in any state other than the swing states. Early on, Donald Trump went to Connecticut a bunch, and people were like, that's crazy. But of course, he was going to Connecticut to raise money. That was the only reason why you ever left the swing states. But, you know, the swing states don't represent America. They're older. They're whiter. They're not necessarily richer. You know, I mean, California and New York are among the richest states, Texas, too. They're not swing states. The swing states are states that are just purple enough that they could flip either way, and that's, again, not the rich. So when you have a president bending over backwards to make the swing states happy, that's not a desire to make the rich happy. That's a desire to make a particular demographic happy. And of course, you know, I don't know how you add up each of these dimensions, and I'm perfectly happy to say the first thing we've got to fix, because this is what I've said for most of the last 12 years, the first thing we have to fix is the corrupting influence of money in politics. I think we should, you know, step back and realize that, geez, you know, if we had a system where, you know, the plutocracy was actually controlling, it actually might be better than the system we've got right now, because at least they'd have a plan. At least they'd be trying to do something. Like, I don't really think that the plutocracy as a whole, not talking about the carbon monopoly, but the plutocracy as a whole, likes climate change. You know, I'm sure they'd love to get fixed climate change. But that doesn't happen, not because the plutocracy is controlling, but because we have these dimensions of inequality that make it so trivially simple for the carbon monopoly to step in and block any change that would affect climate change.
Yeah. A question that I have been asking for many years is, when was the last time that the United States solved a big problem?
Yeah.
And you can, I mean, you can say that we made strides on civil rights in the 60s. And there, you may be able to point a couple of other things. I mean, I guess the Affordable Care Act was a move in the right direction, but solving a big problem, we just don't seem up for it. And well, as Andrew Bacevich points out, we don't win wars either. I mean, you know, what you're pointing out is that it's a paralysis when it comes to actually doing the work of a nation.
Absolutely. I mean, first, yes, I love Bacevich's work. I think, you know, I read every one of his books. It's incredibly important work about the failures of, you know, this military policy, which, again, ties so closely to the economic interests of those who support the military. So, you know, that's another dimension of what we could talk about in this problem. But I actually think we need to be, you know, I actually think the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, those were huge successes. Like, I mean, we didn't solve the problem of racism, absolutely. But that was an inspirational success that Lyndon Johnson engineered. And that success, engineered by Lyndon Johnson, was a success that came from being able to draw together people from both parties. We forget, but the Republicans were an incredibly, critically important part of making that success possible, because there were so many Southern racist Democrats.
Exactly.
Who were never going to allow this to happen. And that was enormous. You know, the Environmental Protection Agency that Nixon gave us, that was an enormous success. The statutes that deal with water pollution and with air pollution, those were really important. I actually think that, you know, we went through a period of the government being able to act in really important ways, and it's really Reagan that begins to dismantle the idea of the government being able to do anything.
Yes,
and,
yes.
Of course, he didn't create the anxiety and skepticism. There's lots of skepticism that had been building during the 1970s. But we need to remember that there was a time when government could work. And we need to get back to that time, because not because I think that every problem should be solved by the government, but there are critical problems that must be solved by the government. Climate change.
And can only be.
Yes, can yeah. only be. That's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And I mean, the one thing that I often point to in the, and I'm sure you include as well, is the Powell memo. And the reaction behind closed doors, sort of, to the successes of the late 60s, early 70s, and that led to so much of what you described now. Now, I want to say that you also, as I pointed out in the introduction, do not blame just the elites whichever ones you're pointing to. But you also say there's a problem with us, and you place the advertising industry and our media, even our news media, at the center of that, a bit of what I mentioned before, how they both that both of them want us crazy, but you do not let us off the hook as well.
Yeah, I think that's true in a causal sense, but I would say that, you know, as much as I think there's a problem with them, the government, and there's a problem with us, the people, them, the government, are more morally accountable for their failure. Like, that's their job.
That's their job description, not ours, yes.
Yeah. That's not ours. And we as citizens, you know, find ourselves in a media environment where it's really hard to do what people expect us to do. You know, I mean, part of the book is about trying to tone down the expectations that we have about how we, the people, are supposed to participate in the project of governance. And one way to see this is, you know, if you take the classical Republican view, not large R Republican, but small R Republican, you know, what the framers would have been obsessed with, they would have said that citizenship is a public office, just like being a judge, just like sitting on a jury, so just like being president, it's a public office. But what's striking is we are the only public officers who are quizzed regularly, right? So when the president speaks, but for this president, but, you know, before this president, we understood when the president spoke after having considered both sides of a question, listened to a bunch of advisors, have a huge staff help him understand what was right and what was wrong, and then on the basis of all that, an announcement was made where he would say something that would represent policy of the United States. You know, if you walked up to Elena Kagan, Supreme Court Justice, and you quizzed her on admiralty law, she'd say, look, you know, you want a question on admiralty law answered? Get a case. Give us some briefs. Get an argument. Then we'll deliberate about it. We'll write an opinion. And our opinion will be the opinion, but it will come at the end of a process. Or even a jury. You know, we don't quiz a jury midway through deliberations. What we do is we give them evidence. We protect them in their consideration of that evidence. They're given a job to deliberate. They have to come to a certain unanimity in their opinion. And then finally, the jury speaks. All of these public offices have the benefit of reflection and consideration and staff supporting them. We the people, however, as we are represented in our democracy, are regularly quizzed on the basis of no information with no opportunity to reflect, and somehow that's taken to be what we believe. But, you know, I think it's a little bit insulting that we are rendered ridiculous because, of course, you know, midway through preparing dinner, you get called and you're asked, should we extend NAFTA? Or what do you think of thorium reactors? And, of course, nobody knows what they're talking about. And if they do, it's really accidental, but they don't want to feel like they're an idiot, so they give a view. I think it's ridiculous that we expect that we, the people, so represented, should be taken to be what we, the people, believe. And instead, we should look for processes of understanding what we, the people, properly represented, believe, and then start pointing to those as ways to represent us more than this kind of ridiculous system that we've evolved in a context where we know we don't know what we're talking about.
Right, right. This is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Lawrence Lessig. He's Harvard Law School professor and author most recently of They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. You can learn more at Lessig, LESSIG.org, and EqualCitizens.us. And Equal Citizens is the what I would say is the thriving website at this point about the work that needs to be done based on the book and laid out in the book. And so in the 20 minutes we have left, Lawrence, let's try to do two things. One, the moves that could fix this, and then what you think is sort of what I sort of see as the centerpiece of how to make those things happen. So I'd love us to have time to talk about both of those. So you kind of say one, two, three, four, five things that need to happen. And I'll just read them. A move immediately to public campaign funding, leading to more representative candidates. A reformed electoral college that gives the president a reason to represent America as a whole. A federal standard to end partisan gerrymandering. The Supreme Court has kind of gotten in the middle of that one. A federal penalty on states that don't secure to their people an equal freedom to vote, as it used to be. And institutions that empower the people to speak in an informed and deliberative way, which is sort of what you were just speaking about. So is that basically the top of the list of what's needed?
Yeah, let's frame what that list represents, though. My view is we've got to have a political movement succeed in credibly stating that they speak for the people when they say we've got to fix this democracy first. And, you know, that might be a presidential candidate with a bunch of people running in Congress who say that they're a reform caucus. You know, the ways to make this happen are many. But the point is, we need to come to a moment in our democracy where we have the ability to step back and say, look, whether you're on the right or on the left, you agree, we need to fix this democracy first. And the way to fix it includes those changes. I mean, except for the, you know, the one about us, let's bracket that for a second. But those changes, which, you know, most, all but the Electoral College ones, were right within the core of what the House of Representatives passed when they passed this bill this year called H.R. 1. H.R. 1 was the most ambitious reform package passed by the House of Representatives since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that bill would have changed the way we fund congressional campaigns, would have had public funding of congressional campaigns, would have ended partisan gerrymandering, would have had automatic vote registration and restoration of the Voting Rights Act. It had an extraordinary anti-revolving door, really strong ethics proposals. What was striking about that bill was not only was the substance right, it was also that it was Nancy Pelosi acknowledging that it had to be first, H.R. 1. It had to be the first thing they do if they're going to get anything else done. And my belief is that we are so close to electing a president who believes the very same thing. We've done a very extensive effort, and others have done this too, to reach out to candidates and get them to make a commitment to what we're calling POTUS 1, which is the kind of H.R. 1 equivalent for the president. And POTUS 1 commitment is like, do you agree that fundamental reform has to happen, and do you agree it's going to happen first? And if you do, what is fundamental reform? And so on our website, if you go equalcitizens.us/POTUS1, the number one, you can see everybody's answers to these questions. And there are 10 candidates, or 9 now that Beto has dropped out, who have committed to fundamental reform as the first thing they will do, including 3 of the top 5. And maybe, it's not clear that Bernie has actually made that commitment yet, but I think it's close to him making that commitment.
And he leads most of his speeches with that claim that we have to fix corruption first.
Yes. So I have no anxiety about Bernie delivering, whether he's made the particular commitment or not. But the point is, we have never been this close.
Right.
You know, in the last 50 years, we have never had a moment when we've had this many people running for president who have identified corruption, the corruption of our democracy, as the thing that they will fix first. Now, whether they will do it or not, of course, is a big question. And I'm extremely frustrated that the media has not spoken about it more, because, of course, if they get elected and it's not the thing they actually have been forced to talk about again and again and again, it'll be easy for them to run away from it.
Right.
But the point is, the setting is on the table, and if we can just get focus on that commitment, then there's a real chance that in 2021 we will have a president who will enact fundamental reform, and 85% of the problems that I'm talking about in this book as it relates to them will be fixed. And that's extraordinary. That's a reason to be enormously optimistic, and also a reason to step up and demand that they take these issues on the road much more aggressively than they are right now.
Right, and that the media ask them about it. It's interesting, you know, you get emails that say, make them have a climate change debate, make them have an incarceration debate, make them have an inequality debate. And, of course, what we need is a representative democracy debate as well. But let me point out 2 things. One, this action of them signing that thing follows 2018, in which there were more democracy reform actions on the ballot statewide around this country than ever before.
Yes, and succeeded more than ever
That's
before.
Right.
Even during the progressive era, it's really astonishing. And I talk about that in the last chapter of the book. I talk about a couple of those. And what's so inspirational about those actions is that they were able to tap into a kind of deep root of American democracy. Like Katie Fahey, the extraordinary 20-something who launched the Michigan anti-partisan gerrymandering effort with a Facebook post, and within a couple months had 4,000 volunteers, and within 6 months had 400,000 signatures on a ballot measure to end partisan gerrymandering. Katie Fahey has had as a kind of religious commitment inside of her campaign the obligation that nobody talk about Republican or Democrat when they were talking about why partisan gerrymandering had to end. This was not like a way to make Democrats more competitive or a way for Republicans to succeed in certain Democratic districts. It was about how to make democracy work in a way that you could be proud to teach your children. And I think that that way of approaching it at the state level has this potential to bring people out in a fight which they are desperate to engage in. I mean, people are so exhausted by the Republican fight or the Democratic fight. Like, you hear that all the time. But when they can be inspired to step up and do something that they feel like is the sort of thing that they would be proud of, you can bring 10 times the number of people to that fight that you can on a partisan fight. So I think that we've seen a success at the state level. The challenge is how to bring that to the federal level. Because unlike at the state level, where you've got these referenda processes where there's a beginning, middle, and end, and you can see victory and you know what victory is like, at the federal level, you know, we've got to get our representatives to do something. And that turns out to be extremely hard, given both the scale and also the ability of your representatives to run away from whatever they've committed.
So you cited that the top-tier Democratic candidates have all committed to this or are all committed to this. And how many of those reforms that they've committed to can happen by executive order, and how many would depend on a vote in the Senate?
Well, nothing is going to happen if Mitch McConnell is the majority leader of the Senate.
Okay.
I mean, he is the Dark Lord, and the Dark Lord has to be removed. There's no doubt.
Okay.
Nothing happens without him gone.
And yet the recent election in Kentucky makes it look like that's more possible than it seemed a month ago.
Absolutely. I mean, he is the most disliked senator in the United States Senate. There's an extraordinary amount of effort in the state to make sure people understand that, you know, he is a very unrepresentative representative of that state. And I think there's a real chance. I mean, you know, a lot hangs on how strong a candidate does, but I think that's a fight that we ought to be pushing as hard as we can to make that possible. But if Mitch McConnell is not the majority leader of the United States Senate, then I think this bill is extremely likely. But I would also say that I would not say that we can fix democracy through executive action.
Right.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, we have to change the way campaigns are funded. That's going to take a lot. I think, you know, the most exciting proposals are the ones that are talking about, like, what Seattle did, giving everybody democracy dollars. You know, that, you know, the story in Seattle in this last election where Amazon stepped in and tried to clean the city council out from people who were, you know, trying to tax Amazon and other rich companies. That story is an extraordinary story about the success of democracy vouchers, because the democracy vouchers, democracy dollars in that state, gave the anti-Amazon candidates a leg to stand on, and many of them succeeded against the money from Amazon. And I think that example should inspire these presidential candidates to find a way to replicate this around the country. So Bernie has committed, we haven't seen the details yet, but he's committed to democracy vouchers, as he calls it. Andrew Yang, early on, committed to everybody getting $100 in democracy dollars. Kirsten Gillibrand, before she dropped out, had a plan that would give up to $600, depending on, you know, whether you had three races or two races or one race. There was a federal race in the election that year. But I think these are really ambitious, exciting proposals that, if they were adopted and if Congress passed it, would radically change the economy of influence in Washington within the first 2 years.
Right. And my sense is, and I sense when you cite optimism as a possibility, yours as well, is that there are feedback loops. That when people begin to see what was considered inevitable and undoable and so on begin to change, begin to happen, I think there's the possibility of a surge of enthusiasm for that, and that's the kind of enthusiasm that is not partisan.
Absolutely. And I, you know, one of the early polls that we did in this, when I was doing this work, was one that found something like 96% of Americans thought it was important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but 91% didn't think it was possible.
Wow.
And so you put those numbers together and you recognize that's the politics of resignation.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we all wish we could fly like Superman, but we don't jump off of tall buildings because we know we can't. But if all of a sudden, you know, there were a pill, you took a pill and you could fly like Superman, there'd be a lot of people jumping off the building. You know, I hope the pill worked. But the point is, like, once you give people a sense of what's possible and they begin to believe it, there's an enormous amount of energy out there that we could tap to make change happen.
By the way.
And that's why I think it's so critical these candidates talk about this, because if it's just a sort of bunch of boxes that they've checked on their website, that they don't talk about every single time and give people a sense, not just of the problem, but of the solution, then I think most Americans are just going to think, that just can't be done. So let's just move on to what we can dream for.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it, but just want to cite, I think the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 was almost that. A socialist from Vermont starts talking about stuff. At first, it was, this is absurd. This is Don Quixote. And he was the one that pulled the 25,000 people into arenas. People got into it. Okay, according to an email I recently received from Common Cause, you know where I'm going now, Lawrence. If only six more states join the call, we could face an Article 5 constitutional convention. And while you and many might see this as an opportunity to correct some of the flaws, doing away with the Electoral College, for example, Common Cause is scared. Up till now, I mean, I will say this, it was like reading this book and considering this interview was, I sort of went, well, maybe, I mean, this prospect has scared the hell out of me. First, what is an Article 5 constitutional convention? How real is the possibility? And am I right to be scared? And let me just say a couple of other things. I feel that we would need to heal an awful lot of tribalism and misinformation before I would want to trust us with a constitutional convention, and that even if we can effectively and constructively achieve sufficient education among the people, which I think is an enormous challenge, we'd still have to contend with all the political, media, big money, big corporation influences on the execution of it, and that's what scares me. The floor is yours.
So look, you got to start with answering the question, do you think we need constitutional reform? Because if you don't, then I agree, there's no reason to try a convention. But if you do think we need constitutional reform, then you got to confront a really important reality. The chances that the United States Senate is going to pass by 2/3 vote any of the really important reform that we need, like let's just take representative integrity, like kind of thing my whole book is about, is exactly zero. Now, I'm all for the people who are fighting for it, and I love the fact that they're trying to get amendments introduced and to rally people around the idea of an amendment. But, you know, the reality is, in America today, an amendment from the United States Senate being proposed to the state, bracketing the question of whether you're going to get 3/4 of the states to enact it, is almost impossible. Okay, so if you need reform, and it's not going to come through the ordinary process of Congress proposing it, what then? Well, the framers of our Constitution thought about this. Just before they were about to release their proposed Constitution, George Mason recognized that they had forgotten to give the people a way around Congress. Mason said, you know, what if Congress, at that stage, the only way to amend the Constitution was a proposal by Congress? And he said, what if Congress is the problem? And immediately they realized they had a mistake, they'd left this hole in their system, and they produced this alternative way of proposing amendments, which is the Article 5 Convention. Now, some people call it a constitutional convention. And when you call it a constitutional convention, that's when you start terrifying people. Because the reality is a constitutional convention, like the convention that drafted our Constitution, isn't really constrained by anything. So a constitutional convention, in theory, would have the power to just say, okay, here's the new Constitution. And I get why people are afraid of that. But the reality is that's not what an Article 5 convention is. Now, I've spent, you know, I have a chapter in each of the two books that I wrote, Republic Lost, that tries to dissuade people of that. Season 2 of the podcast, Another Way, is a whole season devoted to why that's just crazy talk to say that an Article 5 convention would have the power to enact changes to the very mode by which you adopt amendments to the Constitution. So I feel like I've devoted enough of my life to that argument, and I'm happy, you know, in a separate podcast with you, we could go through it. But I think it's crazy talk, literally crazy talk, to say that an Article 5 convention has the power to change the rules by which an amendment to the Constitution gets adopted. It is literally crazy talk. And I love people who make this. Like, Bob Reich is a good friend of mine, and I've had this conversation with him, and he makes that argument, but it's wrong. It is just flat out wrong. And if it's wrong, then the question is, what's the worst that could happen from an Article 5 convention? So let's imagine they propose some crazy amendment, like an amendment that says no longer let's say, even I think a balanced budget amendment would be a crazy amendment.
Yep.
Let's say that they propose that, and that's what the closest convention is, a balanced budget convention. Then the question is, will 38 states ratify that amendment? And what that means is 13 states, or better, one house in 13 states rejecting the amendment is enough to kill the amendment. Now, my view is, if we can't win 13 states, we don't deserve to win on any issue that you've got. And I'm pretty certain that 13 states in the United States right now would certainly reject the balanced budget amendment, especially even a bunch of red states that would quickly realize that if we had a balanced budget obligation, then they, which are net importers of money from the federal government, would be very likely to lose from the consequences of that amendment. So my view is, we need a constitutional amendment in a number of areas, but certainly to deal with the problem of, for example, Citizens United. If we need an amendment, Congress is not going to give it to us. The only path the framers left us was a path that Congress couldn't control, and that's the Article 5 process. And I am perfectly willing to take the risk of that process failing, but failing simply means we don't get an amendment passed. It does not mean that we threaten the Constitution or changing the rules by which an amendment gets adopted, which is what Common Cause, I think, unfortunately, it's really not to its credit that it continues to perpetrate that. Now, of course, it is to its credit in the sense that whenever they send out that email, they get tons of money from people who are terrified of the idea that we're going to lose our Constitution if we don't get our Common Cause to stop this amendment process.
Right.
But it is just not credible. And people who make that argument, I think, are either misleading you or just misled themselves.
Okay, we've got to close it here, but let me see if I'm right about this, that while we might be scared about that second piece that I mentioned, that the moneyed interests would twist this and that would be scary and they'd manipulate it and so on. What you're saying is, bottom line, it's an advisory convention. It does not pass anything. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that
it has to go to the states.
If people are getting those emails, and you're going to get them, and if people are thinking this is crazy, look at they don't represent us, or even simpler, look at equalcitizens.us to find the arguments that make me reconsider something I had been afraid of. We've got to close it here, Lawrence. So again, the new book is They Don't Represent Us. The websites are Lessig, LESSIG.org, and equalcitizens.us. And equalcitizens.us is the one to go and learn about these things in depth and get involved. You can find the podcast Another Way at equalcitizens.us/anotherway. And that's a weekly podcast, right?
That's right.
Okay. And for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to get weekly email announcement from me telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles that I think are relevant and timely and flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site, or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, all sorts of places. You can find years of podcasts. Jeremy Scahill, Michael Lewis, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally. Terrence, thanks to G. Lee, Mark Maxwell, and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Lauren Lessig. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.